2017 has been a year of natural disasters. There have been so many that it can feel almost biblical or like some scary Hollywood movie. I mean, think about it.
This is going to be a very major disaster.
This is an entire highway that is underwater.
South Florida, now in Irma's destructive path.
The major earthquake, a 7.1.
The death toll now officially stands at about 200.
Firefighters in California are working around the clock to contain.
Running out of everything. This is a grim reality people are facing in Puerto Rico after Maria.
2 days after Hurricane Storm is on its
peak. Yeah, it's been a lot. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And today, we have a special show, an hour on the economics of disaster, largely through the lens of Puerto Rico.
Power lines are down.
If anybody out there is listening to us, we are dying.
We head to the island to meet people affected.
My investment is here. My family is here. My home is here.
Examine the destruction.
There is a lot of damage. It's going to be a long journey here.
Look at how the island's debt crisis will affect the recovery.
The debt had become unsustainable.
And break down what comes next in Puerto Rico and in Florida and Texas, too. We start on the island, where the month of September was catastrophic. Hurricane Irma hit on the 6th, Maria on the 20th, causing roughly $100 billion in damage. The official death toll was 58 as of production time, but many, many more cremations have been reported. Puerto Rico has roughly 3.5 million people. Manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, and electronics, along with tourism, power the economy. But the unemployment rate hovers around 11%, and close to half the population lives in poverty. Then there's the debt crisis. Back in May, Puerto Rico declared bankruptcy to the tune of $74 billion. The U.S. territory's governor, Ricardo Rossello, has asked Congress for $94 billion in post-storm aid. All of this is the backdrop for our stories. We're starting on the north coast of the island in the town of Atillo. It's a farming area. The fields are green and the air is thick and humid. And cars have to move slowly here because electrical poles are at 45-degree angles all over the place. That means power lines drape into U-shapes right in front of people's houses. And that is where we met Glorimar Rivera. She's 32, sitting on her front porch with her grandmother, under some shade, trying to stay cool without power. The second floor of her house is in the middle of renovations that started before Maria, open with unpainted bricks and no glass in the windows yet. Rivera rode out the storm at home with her 4-year-old son, her mother, and her grandmother.
Mira, eso, las primeras dos horas.
The first 2 hours, the wind was infernal, but then it was calm for about an hour. We came outside because we thought it was over, but that's when it got worse because it was coming in reverse. That was horrible, horrible. It's an experience that I don't ever want to live through again. The wind was screaming, it was frightening. I've been in Puerto Rico for 32 years. I went through George, I went through Hugo, and it doesn't compare with what we live through. Really, it doesn't compare. It even brings back feelings.
Rivera's home itself had only minimal damage, but all of her furniture, her TV, and some other electronics were ruined. The water came back on around 4 weeks ago. Electricity? That's another matter.
Hace falta mucha ayuda.
We need a lot of help. Lots of people are in need. In terms of food, water, there isn't much water. Ice. There's no power, so we have to keep buying ice to keep things cold, like meat or milk. Help in terms of canned foods, first aid, things like Tussin, medications, because right now everyone has allergies. Everyone has a cold, mosquitoes, and everything that comes with them. There are a lot of mosquitoes. But besides all of that, we're alive. We're here. Some are in worse conditions, but a little help wouldn't hurt.
Rivera works at a Walmart in Atillo. The store suffered its own losses, ruined meats, damaged stock, and it was closed for a month. Even though the doors are open now, Rivera says there's not enough work for everyone. And she's only worked a handful of 3 or 4 hour shifts in almost 3 months. But even now, without electricity or much work to pay the bills, she says she'd rather rebuild her life on the island than leave for the mainland.
como ya yo he estado en Estados Unidos.
It's like starting over on one side. It'll basically be the same thing. So for the time now, I'm going to stay here with my family. The warmth of my family doesn't compare with leaving and venturing out. So at least for the time being, no.
De contento con su cargamento para la ciudad, ay, para la ciudad. Lleva en su pensamiento todo un mundo lleno de felicidad.
You heard Glorimar Rivera talk about struggling with whether to stay or leave the island. A lot of people are having that conversation, and it's a big issue for Puerto Rico's economy. And we'll get to that in a moment. But to understand what the fallout from this year's storms could mean, we need a little economic context. So we went to San Juan's financial district, where things are a lot better than in Atillo. Some businesses are open, though traffic lights are still out. There was even a film crew recording on the street.
Hola.
We were there to see Vicente Feliciano. He's an economist and president of Advantage Business Consulting. And he says to fully get what's happening now, you got to go back a decade to 2006, when a key tax break expired.
The whole economy was structured around two things, federal transfers and manufacturing. Manufacturing, its mainstay was section of the Internal Revenue Code, Section 936, that allows some special advantages to corporations operating in Puerto Rico. That was phase out, and the phase out ended in 2006. So that led to a contraction of the manufacturing sector. Whoever was here because of the tax incentives as the only reason to be here, then they left.
The island slid into crippling recession. It started borrowing more and more to stay afloat. Investors gobbled up the tax-exempt debt. At a certain point, the load was too much, but Puerto Rico wasn't legally able to restructure its debt until Congress passed a law called PROMESA.
The debt had become unsustainable, but there was no mechanism to restructure debt, and so there was no light at the end of the tunnel. Then comes PROMESA, which provides for a mechanism to restructure debt. And that really opens the possibility or a positive outlook for the medium term.
The fallout from PROMESA was painful. It meant a lot of cuts to services, including things like infrastructure that were not in great shape anyway. One of those was the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, known as PREPA, which had issued its own bonds.
When PREPA got into financial difficulties, it could raise already very high electricity rates, which are several times the U.S. levels. It could stop paying bondholders, but actually it didn't have a mechanism to do so. Or it could forego maintenance and capital spending in order to provide money for the bondholders without further increasing rates. That's what they did.
Which brings us to this storm. And one now notorious decision to hire Whitefish Energy to restore electricity. I asked Feliciano how much worse that made things.
A lot. A lot. PREPA chose to retain Whitefish. And so that delayed the response to the crisis. It would still have been a problem. You still have the issue of the lack of maintenance and capital spending, but at least we would have moved faster.
The Whitefish deal was withdrawn after public and congressional pressure, and PREPA's then-director resigned. But all of this, and every day that passes without power, makes leaving the island look more and more attractive.
So in previous hurricanes, you knew that, you know, just wait a couple of weeks, electricity will be back, your job is going to be there waiting for you, and off you go. And nobody thought about a hurricane as a reason to emigrate. This time around, for many people, the hurricane was the last straw. And they said, okay, enough, I'm leaving.
A lot of the people leaving, including some in Feliciano's own family, are young. They have less social capital on the island, a better shot at starting over on the mainland. Feliciano says that, plus which businesses can afford to stay, could change the island forever.
Think about a forest. Some trees will not come back, but others will grow. If the fundamentals of the business are good, they'll come back. What we are having is that a lot of the businesses, their margins were small as a result of the 12-year crisis. Their capital structures were weak, and they couldn't survive Maria's winds. But think about a hotel. It may be shut down for the time being, but tourism is one of the areas that I'm certain is going to come back and going to come back strong. The hotel may be shut down now. Within a year, it's going to be welcoming guests and it's going to be back in service. It may not be back in service with the same owners, but it's going to be back in service with employees and guests and the whole nine yards. There are other businesses which, you know, if you were serving a population that was diminishing and after a hurricane it's even worse, you may not reopen.
That's Vicente Feliciano from Advantage Business Consulting. The stories we tell and the conversations we have on Marketplace are important to make all of us smarter about the economy, how it works, and why it matters. It all comes back to our mission as a nonprofit news organization to help raise economic intelligence across the country. And now we're asking for your help in making this work possible. For as little as $5 a month, you can join us today as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism you can trust. And the payoff comes in knowing you're helping educate and inform people about the economic forces that shape all of our lives. Donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks.
Like 2 months ago, we got power for 2 or 3 days, and then we bought inventory, we started, and then we lost power again.
Sin luz, sin agua, sin teléfono.
Yeah, because the air conditioning, I mean, and you want to watch TV. I mean, once I go home later, there's nothing but heat and mosquitoes.
Everyone, and I mean everyone I spoke with in Puerto Rico, has something to say about power, or rather, the lack thereof. When Hurricane Maria hit, it wiped out electricity across the island. More than 2 months later, many people in places still don't have it. And if it is on, it's not reliable.
And so I actually got to the airport and the power was out.
The airport, somewhere power had actually been restored, but then the grid went down.
So, of course, I was set.
Because this guy, it's his role to restore power to the island.
I'm Colonel John Lloyd.
He's normally the Pittsburgh District Commander for the Army Corps of Engineers, but here in Puerto Rico,
I serve as the Task Force Power Restoration Commander.
That means bringing in 62,000 poles and 6,500 miles of electrical wire.
That's from New York to almost Russia, then millions of other components to the system.
Early one morning, I stopped by the Army Corps of Engineers Command Center based at PREPA, the embattled Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority in San Juan. About 20 people sat around the room, typing and speaking quietly. Some were wearing bright red jackets with the Army Corps insignia on the back. Others were in military fatigues. Almost every wall was covered with reminders of how many days since Hurricanes Irma and Maria, handwritten thank you letters from children, and maps, like this giant one of the island showing where the power line should be.
So it's broken down by transmission lines in yellow here, and that's 230 kV lines.
I started by asking Colonel Lloyd what Puerto Rico's power grid was like even before Maria.
The infrastructure was unstable before Irma and Maria. So you had a very unstable grid, a lot of power outages before the storm. And now you have a Cat 5 hurricane that comes through and rips through the island and causes extreme damage on the transmission lines.
And for people who are new to thinking about this, transmission lines are what moves the power from the plant to...
From the plant, those transmission lines carry power, and then it goes to substations along the way and continues to step it down until it's brought to your house. You see most of the transmission lines were damaged. There's two lines coming out of the south to the north that we're still working on right now. But once those lines are completed, we think we'll have a good transmission loop and have some stabilization.
When someone is out doing that, who is physically doing that work? Where are those engineers coming from? Where are those linemen coming from? Sure. Obviously, the whitefish issue has been a big one in the headlines, but like, who's the manpower?
So for the Corps of Engineers, so we were given specifically the mission from FEMA, and we serve as FEMA's lead engineer. We were then given the mission at the end of September, a mission assignment to kind of lead the planning and design. We have our own contractors that work for us, and we coordinate this very closely with PREPA.
My understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that you all are handling, what, about 70% of it, and PREPA's got about 30? Is that the right figure?
Yeah, I think that's initially what we kind of saw. 70-30, I think, was a good estimate. It may be more 60-40 now, and it kind of changes as we get more boots on the ground.
As you mentioned, this is an island. Where is all of this stuff coming from? And have you been impacted by the Jones Act?
So let me answer your first question. So most of the equipment is being manufactured in the United States. So poles, wire, conductors, insulators, you name it, whatever it is, we have priority to receive that. The bottom line with that is, though, there just is a shortage in the United States with those components based on all the damage that was done during the other hurricane. So it's been difficult to get that manufactured, get it in the pipeline, and then loaded on a ship and brought here.
One of the things that I'm really interested in is the standard to which you can rebuild things. Under the law, FEMA has essentially dictated things can be restored to what they were pre-disaster. Are you making improvements to the grid, or are you just allowed to restore them? Because they weren't in great shape pre-storm.
The mission assignment gives us direction to do temporary repairs to pre-storm conditions. So that's fairly specific. The fact is this, is that all the work that's going to be done is going to be done to standard and to code. We know a lot of the work before the storm wasn't a standard, wasn't a code. So of course, going out there just by doing the work, it's going to be brought up to whatever the current code is for that work to be done. So in one sense, we're bringing it back to better than it was, but at the end of the day, it's going to be back to that pre-storm level of condition, but just better standard, to code, whatever that looks like.
How much of an impact did some of the lack of maintenance have on the lines around the island, and how much has that impacted your work?
I would say significantly in a lot of those rugged areas, the terrain, a lot of the maintenance for the access roads hasn't been done for years. I mean, just driving around, you see a lot of vegetation overgrown on some of the lines. That would be normal work that a utility company would be responsible for. So a lot of that wasn't done. That's caused significant problems at trying to restore the grid, and it's taken longer than it should.
One of the questions I have is when we've been out on the island, when we've been in Atillo or even in Toa Baja, which is not that far from San Juan, there were people who haven't had power for 2 months. And they are frustrated and they are hot. What do you say to them about when they might have power back?
Nobody wants to get the power on quicker than me and my team and PREPA and everybody who's doing this mission. The fact is the challenges are just extraordinary with doing this. I mean, not only the terrain causes us issues, the material, getting people in here, It just is one of the most challenging missions that we've really faced. I've been in many deployments, Afghanistan, Iraq, but these are Americans, and this is important to get the power back onto them.
You said it, they are Americans. Do you think they're being treated the way mainland Americans would be treated in a similar situation?
I absolutely think so. I mean, we have brought in more generators to Puerto Rico than any other disaster mission the Corps has done. So more than Sandy, more than Katrina, more than in Texas, more than in Florida, just doing that mission alone, and it continues to increase. Of course, when the lights are off, it can't be fast enough. You know, we know that. But I think that when you look at the numbers and you look at the response, certainly from the Corps of Engineers side of it, I think you can see that our response has far exceeded other responses.
While the Corps of Engineers is focused on the big picture of restoring power, the daily work falls to crews of linemen with bucket trucks and heavy equipment out around the island. Some of them have contracts with the Corps, and others are there by mutual aid agreements with PREPA, the power authority. Like the team of Con Edison workers who are usually doing work in my neighborhood in New York. But now, they're working on the historic buildings in Old San Juan.
So my name is Johnny Price. I work for Con Edison in New York. And I am the section manager of the Staten Island Overhead Construction Department back home. And here I'm the operations section chief. NYPA, New York Power Authority, is a state entity. They responded to a request for aid from the Puerto Rican Electric Power Authority, PREPA, which is also a state-owned entity. And NYPA asked us, we're a private company, for help. And when we were asked, we came right down. We're lucky that we're like the first wave because we actually have hotel rooms. The next few waves will be staying in a tent city type of thing in an old army barracks. And this is one of the most important areas to San Juan. A lot of businesses are here. A lot of cruise ships pull in here. A lot of cruise ships haven't been pulling in here because the businesses are closed. So that means no one can go to work. There is a lot of damage from what I've been seeing. It's going to be a long journey here. So Old San Juan is a historic district. It's actually a very old Spanish fort, pretty much. So you can't dig in the ground because you have to kind of do an archaeological dig and preserve everything you find. So that led them to put the utility poles on the rooftops, which is definitely new for us. In New York City, we don't do that. But we spent a lot of time looking at it and figuring out the best way to deal with that and replace the poles that were knocked down by the wind and the storm. The people in Old San Juan have been out of power for 75 days since Hurricane Maria. I'm kind of just focused on getting the lights on and doing it safely and keeping my guys out of the hospitals. We got here, and after 3 days of kind of pushing these rooftop poles up, and we were able to get one line isolated that we restored yesterday morning, so that was pretty exciting for our guys. That was our first Puerto Rican power restoration, and we got about 300 customers back. There were some excellent cheers from the buildings. People seemed very happy, and the guys felt great, and that's pretty much why we're here. It always feels good to give people back the amenities they need to live in this era. And when we light up all of Old San Juan, I'm expecting a large party.
That was Johnny Price from Con Edison in Old San Juan. The farther away you move from San Juan, the clearer the problems with power become. Atillo, the northern coastal town where we met Glorimar Rivera, is a major producer of the island's milk. Some businesses here are still closed, power lines loop in front of houses, hanging off crooked poles, and there are piles of debris along the side of the road and the odd cow wandering through traffic.
We're standing in what looks like it was once a barn to hold cattle. There are pieces of the roof hanging off, just sheets of metal. You can hear them behind me. Pigeons flopping around and no people. And there's another big section of metal roof that looks like it got tossed into a field, maybe 40 feet from this barn.
A little up the road, we went to a dairy farm that made it through Maria. Vaqueria Ceiba del Mar sits on 220 acres of lush green land overlooking the ocean. When you pull off the road, you see cows, bales of hay, farm equipment, and just two workers. Like most places on the island, this farm is powered by generators now.
And it's very expensive. We've spent over $20,000 in diesel. It's been frustrating. That generator uses almost 100 gallons of diesel a day.
That's Luis Martinez. He manages the dairy and has worked here for 15 years. The farm's owner actually runs three different places all nearby, but so many cows died during the storm that he was forced to close the other two and move all his cows here.
Right now we have 800 cows. Before the hurricane, there were about 350, 370. The other 500 to 600 cows were from the other two farms. We had to join them all.
How did you do it? How did you get all of those cows here?
We had to walk them through the streets. The farms are all nearby. We spent like 8 hours bringing them all here.
But Martinez says this farm isn't really big enough for 800 cows.
Those cows on your left are all sick. We have them there with no shade because the hurricane took their roofs.
Roughly 200 cows died during or after Maria, costing the farm about $600,000. And although some of the equipment and structures are insured, the cows are not. The cost to replace just one animal? $2,600. But they're not producing as much as before.
After the storm, did the cows fall off in milk? Sometimes, like something that scares them, they can stop their milk production. So I'm curious, were they still making milk?
Yes, it dropped. Their production dropped. And some that were brought over weren't used to this farm. So those wouldn't produce as usual. To this day, they still don't. We're producing about 4,000 liters less than we were before, all three farms combined.
Not only is milk production down, but the first week after Maria, Martinez had to throw out about 18,000 gallons of milk that spoiled.
It must be just incredibly frustrating to both get through the storm, but then also have to get rid of all this expensive milk.
Yes, it's very painful seeing good product get thrown out. The product was good. The cows and the job was being done as normal. The disinfecting process, the cleaning process, the equipment maintenance and costs, they were all the same. Just to throw out?
Yeah. Do you know between the cows, the milk, the damage, what the sort of total losses were in terms of, in terms of money financially?
I'm not sure, but it's probably close to $1 million.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture approved up to $12 million specifically to help dairy farmers feed their animals for 30 days.
It was the biggest help they could have given us because it was one of the biggest issues.
Still, Martinez has concerns about Puerto Rico's dairy industry for the long term, and it all stems back to reliable power on the island.
There are going to be few dairy farms left on this island, and if they don't fix the power up to standards, there will be a problem where the plants pick up the milk but don't have anyone to sell it to. Because if supermarkets don't have power, they won't buy your milk. Stores aren't taking milk because it will go bad.
That was Atillo dairy farmer Luis Martinez.
A mi Puerto Rico, cubierto de cemento, el verdor no se está viendo, la juventud está perdida, los niños están muriendo, le hace falta cariño, le hace falta alimento.
Even in the midst of the disaster, there can be an upside. There aren't many places you can go in Puerto Rico right now without hearing that sound, the hum of diesel generators. Residents and the government are spending hundreds or even thousands of dollars a week on fuel. That, plus the grindingly slow restoration of the electrical grid, have people thinking about alternatives.
Prior to Maria, people were turning to solar basically for, to save money. Electricity costs here in Puerto Rico are expensive.
That's Alejandro Uriarte. He runs New Energy, a solar design and installation company based in San Juan. 1 kilowatt hour of solar-powered energy here costs around 6 cents. From the grid, it's closer to 33 cents. But post-Maria, the demand for solar isn't about money, but power.
They just want something to power their home, especially the fridge, a couple of fans, lights, the basic necessities.
But it's not cheap, especially on an island that has been in a recession for a decade and where almost half the population lives in poverty.
A system will cost you around $15,000. And if you're going to add storage or a battery to that, it can add on another $10,000.
Uriarte says that New Energy has gotten as many orders since Maria as it would in a typical year. And the requests are split 50-50 between businesses and homeowners. Across town, one of those batteries to store solar power is being installed.
My name is Jose Trinidad. I am an electrical engineer for New Energy.
Normally, an installation takes about 3 days. But right now,
the materials here in Puerto Rico are very scarce. They are not available as they do before.
Which is slowing down the process. Even with the delays, the orders keep coming in. But when I ask Trinidad if PREPA, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, supports solar?
That's a good question.
It's not a no exactly, but more people installing their own solar systems may mean less revenue for PREPA.
So if it affects your economy or your market, you will try to put some things in our way in order to slow you down.
Still, PREPA has a long way to go to fix the traditional grid, which is a business opportunity, albeit a slightly uncomfortable one, for solar entrepreneurs like Alejandro Uriarte.
This change to solar was going to happen, but the hurricane just accelerated what was coming anyway.
You can read more on how power is being restored to Puerto Rico on our website. Just go to marketplace.org. November 30th marked the end of the Atlantic hurricane season, but there have been 17 named storms, including Harvey, Irma, and Maria. They racked up more than $200 billion in damages, making it the most expensive U.S. hurricane season on record. And it's not just the devastation. There's the cleanup, the loss of work and pay, the emotional time and effort spent trying to get help, or figuring out how to rebuild your life and home when savings and investment don't exist. In a moment, we'll head back to Puerto Rico to hear how nonprofits can fill the gaps. But first, we're going to Southeast Texas, which was walloped by Hurricane Harvey back in August. The coastal town of Rockport, population 10,000, was especially hard hit. It's a tourist town, mostly charter fishing and bird watching. The eye of the storm actually made landfall there, and local officials say up to a third of the town's full-time residents are displaced. There are no vacancies in hotels, even for those who got FEMA vouchers. Many people live in damaged RVs, some in tents. Marketplace's Andy Euler has our story.
Like a lot of people in Rockport, Angela Trevino and her family are living in their house, even though it flooded after Hurricane Harvey. The 3-bedroom lime green ranch house now sits alone on their street. Most of the neighbors' homes got completely wiped out. Trevino plans to repair the house, room by room.
We have roof damage, which we have tarps on. There is mold that is now starting to grow. So we stripped all the carpet in the room. We kind of tapered off that room so nobody's in that room.
She knows the mold is a health risk for her, her husband, and their 4-year-old and 6-year-old. But the family doesn't have much of a choice. They applied for FEMA disaster relief, but were denied. And it's not just them there. They've got extended family living in the damaged house, too.
There's one room that doesn't have any mold or anything, and so there's one family that's in that room. There's another family that's in another room that's way in the opposite side of the house, and then me and my husband and our 2 kids are in the living room.
It's a complicated situation, and it was complicated before the storm. 3 families lived on the property and used the same address.
We all applied for FEMA. We all applied for Red Cross. FEMA was complicated because it's one per household. Red Cross is also one per household. because the houses are on a lot and we share one address, we all got denied.
No temporary housing assistance to pay for hotel rooms or to rent a place. No cash assistance for everyday needs. Bima says Trevino and the families on the property should appeal and try to get some assistance. Her reply?
Done with that. Yeah, there's just no point in going through the trouble, really.
But even if the Trevinos got housing assistance, right now there's practically no place to stay in Rockport. They would have had to find shelter in another town, and Angela would have to commute to her job with the district attorney. Rockport's mayor, C.J. Wax, says the housing situation's terrible.
Every apartment building in town was damaged to the point that it is unoccupiable today. So the availability of what I will call middle-income and lower-middle-income housing is extremely limited.
Many people who got FEMA money for housing are using it to rent places or get hotel rooms in Corpus Christi, 30 miles away. And what about the temporary homes that FEMA itself provides, the MHUs, manufactured housing units? The mayor says they've been slow to come. I drove up to one in a rural area outside of Rockport along Rattlesnake Point. It stands out because you can count the standing homes here on your fingers. Renee Cartini and her husband Beau just moved into this one last week. It's a 1,200-square-foot, 3-bedroom, 2-bath mobile home, nearly the size of the house they lost to Harvey.
This wasn't something that we expected. It was not something that we signed up for. I just went on and I registered with FEMA, so I'm not even sure how we were chosen.
They can live in the unit for 18 months, but they have to show progress rebuilding their house. Cartini knows they're lucky. They had been living in a camper with no kitchen, no plumbing. But she still feels guilty when so many people in Rockport have nowhere to stay.
I know my neighbors are happy for us that we did get it. They were almost excited as I was about it. But then it still comes back to they were in the same situation, and I do know that they're on the list and that they are going to be getting a home. But it comes back to that, when is it going to happen?
It's a question Mayor Wax is asking federal and state officials, too. Fewer residents means a smaller tax base. He says he wouldn't blame anyone who relocates permanently. After all, what can he tell them?
Right now, I have no place for you to live.
FEMA and Texas officials say they're getting more mobile units into the area as fast as they can. They're even bringing in RVs, easier to get, easier to place. But if people have found jobs and enrolled their kids in school elsewhere, a temporary home may not be enough to lure them back to Rockport for good. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Aturdido y abrumado por la duda de los celos. Se ve triste en la cantina a un bohemio ya sin fe.
Florida is dealing with a housing issue of its own. Hurricane Irma made landfall in the southwest of the state on September 10th, destroying buildings, businesses, and everything in its path. But as home to one of the largest Puerto Rican communities in the U.S., it's also coping with a large influx of islanders leaving their homes after Maria. Since October 3rd, almost 200,000 Puerto Ricans have arrived in Florida. Marketplace's Renata Sego is in Central Florida, where there's a steady flow of new arrivals every day. Hi, Renata.
Hi, Lizzie.
What are you seeing in terms of how the community in Florida is responding to Maria?
Well, when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, it was as if it hit Central Florida, particularly Orlando and Kissimmee, where we find the largest Puerto Rican community in the state. Before Maria hit, Central Florida had become this hub for Puerto Ricans who'd left the island for jobs. It's been a slow migration dating back maybe 30, 40 plus years. But after Maria hit, families really began reaching out to families. It's been people sending for nieces, nephews, parents, and grandparents, and for the most part, bringing them into their homes here. It's also been a lot of strangers reaching out and helping in the best way that they can.
Yeah, we met a lot of people on the island who were considering leaving. Who have you met there who have left the island and come to Florida?
I've met all kinds of people. So I've met people in the hospitality industry, professionals on the island, doctors, educators, business owners. I've met a lot of students. I met one man who'd been camped out in the airport lobby for about 3 days with his wife and kids. His name is Jonathan Gonzalez. He had actually left Puerto Rico a year ago and was living and working in Memphis, and his family had stayed behind in Puerto Rico. And after Maria, he sent for his family to be with him in Memphis. He'd been living with a friend but moved in with his family into a motel because there wasn't a lot of space. And after a week or so, they were getting low on money. It's just a lot going on.
Yeah. So what did they do?
Well, they ended up paying someone $200 to drive them 12 hours to the nearest hurricane relief center, the nearest official one, that is, here in Orlando. There are three of those centers in Florida. One is at the Orlando International Airport. It's got about 20 agencies, 10 to 20 on any given day. They're walking people through how to get immediate needs like food and shelter and medical care.
With three kids, it's very hard to be in the street or stay in, like we are right now in the airport. You see, they have to be sleeping in the floor, been crying the whole day because they want to be in a house, you know, sleeping in a bed.
So yeah, Jonathan Gonzalez, he told me the airport felt like a 5-star hotel compared to the island. Now Gonzalez and his wife eventually did get placed in a FEMA hotel where they have the option to stay through January. But Gonzalez told me he really wants to move because here in Central Florida, it's easy to find a job, but it's really hard to afford rent. So far, FEMA's placed families in about 1,500 hotel rooms temporarily.
Well, yeah, this brings up the question of housing. Where are people staying if they can't get placed in a FEMA hotel or they can't stay with family?
They're staying in shelters or cars. Some non-governmental agencies are meeting those needs with the resources they can. But the shortage of readily available affordable housing has been a problem here for some time in Central Florida. I spoke with Viviana Janer. She's a commissioner in Osceola County, which has grown really by leaps and bounds in the past 30, 40 years because of migration from Puerto Rico. And that area is continuing to grow by the month because of the influx of evacuees.
You know, it's going to come to a time, whether it be for some people 3 months down the road, for others 6 months or maybe a year, where they're going to have a job and they're going to want to find their own permanent residence if they choose to stay here in our county.
Well, so have officials like her, have other people made any headway in terms of other housing options?
There's been a lot of talk, Lizzie, a lot of talk at the local and state level about housing. But really, at this point, it's unclear. It's unclear whether Florida's governor, Rick Scott, will request money from the federal government or if the Florida legislature will allocate money for affordable housing development in the long run. What is clear is that the Puerto Rican community was already a growing presence, and it's going to be even bigger. From an economic standpoint, we're seeing a boost in people looking for jobs. We're seeing a boost in people who are going to be consumers. From a cultural perspective, more Puerto Ricans, they're outpacing Cubans as Florida's largest Hispanic group. There's more Spanish speakers. And politically speaking, that says something too. This is a group that will now be a part of a conversation here locally about resources for the city, the county, the school districts, businesses. And it's just interesting. We'll have to see how it goes.
That's Marketplace's Renata Sago reporting from Orlando. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
While thousands of Puerto Ricans are leaving the island after Maria, lots of people chose to stay and help others.
My investment is here. My child was born here. My family is here. My home is here. So that's why I haven't considered it yet.
That's Michelle Rodriguez, the executive director of Niños de Nueva Esperanza. It's a local nonprofit in the Sabana Seca neighborhood of Toa Baja, about 15 miles outside San Juan. The area was very hard hit And outside the nonprofit's tidy modern building, there are damaged homes and piles of debris on the road. The neighborhood was already economically depressed, and locals are doing a lot of cleanup on their own. When we meet her, Rodriguez is dragging a heavy generator through the center's lobby because there's no power. Niños de Nueva Esperanza fills a lot of roles in this high-poverty area. It provides a safe space for local kids. There's a small garden of succulents and orchids. Volunteers host workshops, serve meals, and run health fairs. In a previous life, this building is where drug deals went down. Now it has a computer lab and library, but damage sustained by Maria means those rooms are closed now.
Our ceilings were damaged by the storm. We also had damage with the air conditioning system, so none of those are working by now. And that's a problem because every time it rains, it, that's why you see the stains of water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it leaks.
Rodriguez estimates that running Niños de Nueva Esperanza normally costs about $400,000 a year. Even after the hurricane, the community needs more help than ever. Translation services, negotiating with FEMA, clean water, hot meals.
We have been able to find some help for that. We established alliances with other community members, other organizations, other volunteers, churches, and thank God for that because we have been receiving help to rebuild some ceilings, specifically for families that cannot have any other help for that kind of job and or people that are sick or elderly people.
And right now, after the storm, when they're needed the most, balancing the budget is tough.
We are a nonprofit, so we depend on activities to fundraising. And those activities were the major activities that we do in the year were canceled because of the emergency state. So that gives us like another challenge because we do pay people from the community to work with us.
Out back, child-sized seats and a jungle gym provide a splash of color in an otherwise destroyed scene. A neighbor's chickens are making a racket, and there's a huge pile of debris just outside the gate that hasn't been taken away.
I mean, just looking around, I can see there's a tarp there and debris over there.
This is a pretty sight comparing to the first days after Maria. I think that one of the most sad visuals, maybe, was those of the
take your time.
The first week after Maria, because as I told you earlier, we are at a very poor community, so a lot of houses here were not flooded, but here the winds were like awful. Many of the people that gather here and work here for the community efforts or as employees are members of this community, so they were also very affected by the hurricane.
And while donors and the community are coming together to help each other, there's a bigger question that the piles of debris hint at. When it comes to taking it away, getting the power back on, rebuilding Puerto Rico, who is in charge?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure who is in charge, who should be accountable for what is happening in the island. Again, it's a very frustrating process for us because we don't know where to go or who should we go for answers. And people need answers.
I want to add some of my final thoughts to this special. I've covered several disasters, and one thing I've seen is that the last question we asked Michelle Rodriguez, who is in charge, becomes even more important as time goes on. Because recovering from devastation takes a lot of work and even more communication. Right now, there's the territory's governor, the federal government, FEMA, the Army Corps, PREPA, and a financial oversight board created by Congress in the debt crisis. It's a lot, even without the post-disaster politics that often come into play. And so we'll keep covering it. Plus, lots of things we couldn't get to in this hour. How the storm affected education and healthcare in Puerto Rico. How a warming climate changes both disasters and the way we rebuild from them. And most importantly, the stories of people living on the island and the choices they make or are forced to make going forward. And you can read more about the people we spoke with, the stories we covered, and see some pictures of where we were. Just go to marketplace.org. And that is it for this special edition of Marketplace Weekend. The show is produced by Eliza Mills, Peter Balanon-Rosen, and Daisy Palacios. Joanne Griffith is our senior producer. Jake Gorski is our engineer. A special thanks to Ronald Perez for his help on the island. Evelyn LaRubia is Marketplace's executive editor. Deborah Clark is our senior vice president and general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.